substance equals spurn. The propaganda's a win, stress feeding on my tension. My countrymen, they love their fiction. Words are now displayed with good intentions.
Welcome to 1 of 200, the New Zealand Politics and Media podcast. I am one of your hosts, Philip. Welcome back to another week of current events. We're going to talk about the Treaty Principles Bill and then the global economy, basically tariffs and the US and China and all that good stuff. We also have Ginny. How are you, Ginny?
I'm surviving. I'm getting there.
Nice. Almost but not arriving.
I've never arrived. I haven't arrived in many years.
Oh, Ginny.
Okay, so it sounds like we're talking about
something. You need to get better dates. You need to get better dates.
We're digging up. Oh, Simone, how are you?
Thank you. I thought you said Furlip, like you were naming the moustache on your face.
I'm fine with that.
That's right. I'm doing okay. I'm in Tamaki Makaurau. I'm no longer in Kirikiriroa, except for when I have to be, which is, you know, more frequently than one would like. So
it's the same situation as everyone who lives in Tamaki Makaurau. So welcome to our lives.
I never saw you people down in the hood.
For good reason. Okay, we avoided the area for good reason.
Only when we had to, same as you.
It doesn't have any work cafes.
All right, tell us about your work cafes, Simone, to kick off.
Oh, no, you need to start with, this is the agenda on the list.
We did do that. We just did that.
Did you? No, yeah. What's the first thing that we're talking about?
Treaty Principles Bill.
Thank you. Okay, now I have an anti-woke cafe story a la Jacob Wall, if you're a normal person listening to this and not like a Twitter freak, you won't understand what that sentence means. But we're about to explain that. I was at an upmarket cafe called Matilda's or Bendito's or something like that. And this is an audio medium, Jenny. They can't see you laughing. It was whatever it was called.
They all have the same names. They all have
Bambina.
Bambina.
Vaguely European sounding, but in a patronizing way, right?
They're calling it Bambina.
And it's all blonde and gray haired people between the ages.
They made Bambi small. They said it couldn't be done. They said that she was too big. She was too big. She wasn't cute enough. Okay. Why are you both musing? This is beautiful gold. I was at an anti-woke cafe. It was upmarket. It was rich. I arrived early for brunch. Why did I arrive early for brunch? Because I am chronically late to every friend hang that we have. And therefore, I have a karmic debt to repay, or else my soul will have to go through samsara again.
Yeah.
So
born as a cockroach.
That's right. And not just
that over here.
And not just what the conservatives are calling me. So I showed up early, and then I made sure to get us a table because this place was packed full. And I sat down next to these two old white ladies who were waiting for a table inside in the middle. And while I was sitting there, they were discussing how, and I'm not joking, if you've ever been in the classical music world, there's like a received pronunciation, New Zealand accent, and they had that, talking about status, etc. And so they were saying to each other, well, one of them was making the argument to the other, listen, I really like David Seymour. You know, he's so close to my heart. And I think he's been a very good MP. But this Treaty Principles Bill, don't you think he's causing division by stoking this? Don't you think he's being unfair to the Maoris? And I was like, what is going on here? I meant that at this anti-woke rich people cafe, and I'm overhearing the exact demographic saying he's fucked up and he's done something that's made them lose respect for him. And then who should literally go to that same cafe with a takeaway coffee but David Seymour himself, who like briskly speed walked away like it was that episode of Malcolm in the Middle where Hal does that, and he's like kind of not actually touching his supposed romantic partner. They're like, you know, 3 feet apart because Jesus needs to be in the middle or something. And then he's also got the security guy, but he decided that he wanted to drive his sedan or whatever that's got his terribly obnoxious face on it. But I was like, wow. And they pointed him out or else I wouldn't have noticed him. I was like, oh, these people are real. These MPs actually exist in real life. Because, you know, you never see them when you're from my sort of social milieu. But I couldn't believe it. He's losing the demographic.
Yeah, that's fascinating, right? And it feels like over... at least only this year, really, there's been kind of a change in tone, not just from like issue polling, but from kind of mainstream established media perspective, that it's gone from, don't we need to have this conversation, to kind of, well, we're having the conversation and it's not going how we expected it to, which is what we had discussed, right, months ago. And when David Seymour was pushing this, and the received kind of wisdom on the left was, this is a wedge and it's going to become an issue for the next election, which I still 100% think is true, by the way. That's why he's doing it. That's why he's doing it, right? And his circle thinks that's a winning tactic. But it depends what your metrics of winning are, you know? Like, as leftists, we have a more encompassing and expansive version of, for example, like public involvement and just the public square, right? And the ideas of property and constitutional arrangements and all these things. Like, we're not happy with how things are either, right? So in a way, we're not being served by ignoring and pushing down the concept of like re-understanding what the treaty is, you know. In the 70s, there was like the treaty is a fraud. That stuff's been like kind of changed through time, and the understanding of more left kind of indigenous activism in the like actual Maori land back movement has changed through time and the way that that's been perceived. But that's conveniently ignored by everyone in the kind of, you know, for gross misrepresentation of it, the kind of establishment media center, or that's the kind of neoliberal perspective that they want. They don't want to be discussing this stuff either, which is why, like, the people who get angriest about the concept of the Treaty Principles Bill, other than the people who are like directly affected, are people like Matthew Hooton, right? The neolibs, who don't want there to be a conversation about renegotiation of constitutional norms, because those norms were serving them quite well, thank you very much. And like John Key, quote unquote, did well by the Maoris, and like that's all you need to do, right? Tick some boxes and move on, right? You don't need to renegotiate your relationship with the state or go back to, you know, what would Ma Tiki Mai imply? That is a fundamental rearrangement of our, you know, state constitutional arrangements and how people can engage with different parts of society and which parts of the security state are actually harming, like a fundamental part that built our society. All those like big questions, you know, and what do we deserve? What are our kind of positive rights in the society? That's all being kind of left by the wayside. So that's why I sort of had an inkling that this was a good for us. This is a good can of worms for them to be opening, because we get to start asking those questions when otherwise, Lord knows, the establishment media won't be asking those questions themselves, right? And it takes, you know, you can try to move heaven and earth, but Hone Hardaway is not going to be on the 6 o'clock news talking about like what vision he'd like to have. Whereas, sure, you can get David Seymour on there, Mr. 1%, when that was the case. Somehow that's a fine, you know, perspective to ask. But then the counterpunch to that, I think, is, well, now, you know, now we're just asking questions. Is it fine what we currently have? I don't think so. And like, I think there's a case to be made that this opens room for a riposte from the left that we didn't have before. Sorry to hand it to David Seymour again, but that's, look, it's a win, I think. It's a win for the left. Like, voting down this heinous bill, obviously, is fantastic, and it was like comprehensively destroyed, and there were some very cool and like inspiring moves in the House. But that's all performative, right? House stuff is pretty much performative, and we knew it was going to be voted down. But to me, the exciting kind of undercurrent of it is, I reckon this has changed public opinion in that soft underbelly that Simone was talking about, so that when we do come to that referendum, whether citizens initiated or a negotiation for the next government that Seymour will want to push again, the pushback will be so much stronger. Look at the hikoi, right? I don't think that hikoi could have come if he'd jumped straight to a citizens initiated referendum. I think the lead up has actually given us some runway. Sorry to get private sector, but like, it's given us the time to kind of build the momentum to fight back, where I don't think that existed a few years ago. I might be off piece. What do you think, Jenny?
Yeah, I was just going to actually ask what you think would be the next steps for the ACT Party, because I think specifically in his comments after being told that his bill was disgusting and shitty and terrible, he brought up the end of life choice law. And how basically, essentially, in submissions, almost all the entire country opposed it. But at a referendum, it passed 65 to 35 or something like that. So I guess I wonder if that's something that I do want to ponder is I don't know if I think there is a chance that we see this, that there will be a portion of people who are, I suppose, really involved in campaigning because they saw the threat of this bill as very, very real and very, very present. I think lots of comments were also being made specifically by Te Pāti Māori MPs about how this was the start of something. And there was lots of conversation and discourse around how if we let this one thing move the needle in politics, it's going to open up a whole other can of worms for the government. And I wonder if people will see that we've defeated this, essentially, and almost become too politically complacent. Like, oh, you know, being reassured that most of the country feels that Māori people should have better, or at least should maintain their existing rights that the Crown has granted them. I say granted in the loosest possible sense. But what if, you know, it's that kind of herd mentality of like, okay, so everyone shares my left-wing views, so surely we're just going to operate like we're going to operate in good faith all the time politically. We're going to accept that everything that people think in the world will be reflected by our politicians, and that will be fine. And I'm kind of worried about that being the state of events going forward. I think almost having a longer runway, again, to get corporate, I think a longer runway leaves you more time to prevaricate, essentially, and go, oh, like, thank you. Like, I did so well in the intellectual exercise. And I think almost seeing how this has played out from a social media perspective, especially, I think it's given New Zealand so much prominence in global media, but I don't know if the rhetoric or discourse around that is what we really wanted as a country. I've seen so much pickup of this stuff from obviously colonial news outlets like BBC, like Canadian outlets and stuff, and then going like, oh wow, like the proud Māori people standing up for their rights. Like, did we want this globalized narrative of our, I guess, fight as Māori and Māori allies to be used, to be talked about with this noble savage language? Do you know what I mean? And I feel like a thing that we've been examining recently in the evil corporate sphere is actually, we've been surveying New Zealanders obviously about how they feel about things like the ideas of Kiwi success. And there are these huge corporate surveys that go out every year that finish kind of around this time right now, which government and advertisers will use to say stuff like X percent of Kiwis love having dinner at home, or like X percent of Kiwis like love Winston Peters or some shit, like that kind of stuff. But we're kind of wrapping up those surveys now in the corporate market research sphere. And in terms of how Kiwis themselves and New Zealanders themselves feel about, I guess, how we're portrayed on the world stage, there is a, how would I put this delicately? They don't like, I guess, that the focus of New Zealand discussion is actually somehow embedded in this particular discourse around Māori rights. So all that is to say, while people might be going to woke, non-woke cafes and saying, oh, the bill is so divisive, like how could we take away people's rights? These very same people, I guess at their core, are kind of holding that thought about the divisiveness in one part of their brain, and the other part of their brain is going, but we should be known for other things. And there is some resentment still, that kernel of resentment about how much we as a country or a government push or focus on our Indigenous population. So that's what I want to watch out for, I think, going forward, is that people do hold those two things together. There can be pride in Aotearoa that is held by, I guess, woke or non-woke white allies. And whatever they say about this bill now and how they think it's, you know, inhumane and they should keep things as status quo, it's exactly like what you said with John Key. They just want to keep Māori happy. They want to take some boxes, but they would rather that we weren't known for this at all on the world stage. And that's going to be tough to reckon with on a referendum level.
No, I totally agree. That's the risk, right? But I guess, like, my background perspective has always been we're in the minority. So I guess it depends, like, where we're coming at this from, this debate, right? If you're the Labour Party or the National Party, of course you don't want to have this conversation, because, like, it and it also depends what you think of the word divisive, right, and what that means to you. Like, I think that's the key word that people keep bringing up, and Simone, like, that's the exact point, right? They said divisive. They didn't say, like, they disagree with the intent. They probably agree with the intent, but they don't want to be having this conversation. They don't want New Zealand to be known for this thing. So it's almost like a retread of the Tim Walz thing. It's like, they're weird. Like, they're making this conversation something that we don't want to be having as a society. And as long as we, being the left, the constitutional left, who want to be, like, retreading Māori rights in a more substantive way and talking about tinoranga, tiratanga, and, like, more in broad kind of encapsulations of what citizenship is, as long as we can be seen as pushing back against something that's fundamentally making the conversation into something that the vast majority of New Zealanders don't want to be having, then that gives us leverage to be the kind of populist responders as opposed to instigators of something that makes the rich white Epsomites uncomfortable, which I think is like it's not a situation I think I've ever seen before in my lifetime. Like, think back to the Helen Clark, Don Brash era. That was very much like populist New Zealanders against any like retread of this, you know? It's rip Foster and Seabed, rip the band-aid off, like no rights for Māori, legal avenues won't get you anywhere. That like background is where I was have always kind of come at this from. And therefore, like, the constitutional avenues are kind of foreclosed to us without any kind of like populist insurgency through politics, like capital P politics. Simone, I'm sure you've got plenty to add.
Of course, I just forget everything all the time. I think I don't disagree with what you're saying, Philip, but I do think it's worth remembering that, and not to say that you've forgotten this, that oftentimes when we say, okay, this is breaking the norm, this is kind of widening the conversation, that the only voices which are ever allowed on the news will be that the alternative is the extreme right one. And so I am worried that if it is, you know, having a conversation, that we won't actually get those alternative constitutional ones, because the left voices, which we've primarily seen, I think, on the news about this have just been in defense of, you know, the existing treaty principles. Mm-hmm. And it's like you say, you know, we want to have a conversation about the fundamental constitutional arrangements of this country, and we ought to. When the bill was first put forward, one of the lines that was being run was, these principles of the Treaty of Waitangi are all, they're all, you know, judicial activism. They're judicially created. This wasn't something that we had some kind of national conversation about, which the answer is both no, but also yes. And I agree with that from the opposite perspective. Like, again, I don't want to get the case wrong. I think it is one of the Attorney General against New Zealand Māori Council cases, maybe 1986, I could be wrong, where Lord Cook, or I think President Cook as he then was, lays out, you know, these are the kind of fundamental principles that one can draw from the treaty, and this is the way that this ought to be understood when we go forward, and that. And those are all things which are not in the actual text of Te Tiriti, right? And if you were to look at the text of Te Tiriti, they are much, much more extreme left in our current environment than what was being put forward as a kind of placation by the courts. And in fact, the Waitangi Tribunal, when it gives a redress, I think it was explicitly said by our Court of Appeal that redress can't actually be the value of what was taken, because that would bankrupt the New Zealand government, because the theft has been so widespread, right? This land would be worth hundreds of billions, if not trillions, you know, if all of this were to be given back, if there was to be some kind of redress or reparation for everything that was done, even just to get back to baseline zero, this would destroy New Zealand as a state. And therefore, much like in Mabo in Queensland, there must be like the spine of tenure cannot be broken, is I think how the High Court of Australia puts it in that case, right? This fundamental principle that the king is the sovereign and supreme, and Māori are kind of this perhaps slightly protected class that we kind of have to, you know, have some form of equity to in terms of health or aiming towards this and that in the government, as opposed to this is whenua Māori. And in fact, everybody else is a visitor on it. And so our constitutional arrangements ought to be rearranged by the indigenous people here who decide how everything ought to be arranged, right? Which is the way that it should be done if you read the text of Te Tiriti itself. So it's not a disagreement with that. It's that I'm not sure we're going to be able to have that conversation, because I think that all of that will be shut out of the news. And I am worried that it is only going to be the alternative is, you know, current neoliberal status quo versus, you know, this extremist sort of view. And then that ratchet effect happens with that. That is one of the things that I sort of do have concern about. And it is worth noting that when you're at these anti-woke cafes or whatever it is, and you know, you have these people decrying the kind of, you know, like, oh, I just worry that it's too divisive in that. That to me illustrates how strong the radiating Hitler particles are in our media, that it was presented as, you know, Seymour's extremist minority view as some kind of thing to be taken seriously and given airtime about, when people who are supposed to be in the demographic that would be, you know, in favor of are saying, no, I think this is too much for us. You know, it just shows how craven the media are in this country, how craven the press is. And that is worrisome going into the next election, I think. And it's only going to get worse. I mean, we think about how the ownership of our media entities is getting taken over by some more extremist, like actively far-right political multimillionaires, billionaires. You know, there is a real movement. And I think that because it is all and always interconnected, that what the ramp up in genocide in Gaza post the 7th of October has really shown is that if this can be done for that issue, it can be done for almost any issue, you know, because it is, it's a kind of omerta, like to become a made man, right, in the mafia, you got to kill somebody, because then it's like, well, you're in, you know, you can't turn back, that sort of thing, right? Like this is, that to me is what the coverage of the genocide has been for every other issue. Is like, okay, we've got you, you won't quit your job, you won't push back, we've got you hook, line and sinker, you are going to be a loyal lapdog now. And that worries me for the treaty principles.
Yeah, that's a great comparison. Like I said, there was like a lot of what's called stir and drum, right, the German expression, but like it felt kind of frothy, the day of cancellation of the treaty principles bill. Like, good, right? It you're allowed to celebrate the wins, and that's awesome. And we should, right? That's a win. But to bring my classic like half empty perspective, like we knew it was going to get voted down, and also like the people who are taking such great pleasure in a win that wasn't of their own making are not making the same kind of noise about things that they could be making a difference on, right? The regulatory standard stuff, which could potentially presage like a bigger change in the kind of legal fundamentals that we legislate based on, and that, you know, the kind of power dynamics in our society end up relying on. Yeah, I share all your concerns, Simone, and like the media environment is probably the biggest concern, I would say, for like the left and kind of the center left at the moment, electoral politically, for sure, because there's no aperture, right? And the Overton window from the establishment media is only going right. I don't see any kind of Leonard Cohen-esque cracks for the light to come through in that kind of perspective, which is pretty depressing. But we need to make those cracks, right? And like without any organic sympathy coming from those quarters, we need to like stir enough noise. The Hannah Might Be Clark moment was so illustrative of that. I think like if you know you're in the minority, you can make noise and force yourself to be covered. You're not going to be covered in the way that you want to be covered, right? Like they're not our friends, you know. The media is not our allies. The people on like 6 o'clock news are against us. So like I think if you come at it from that perspective, and I don't know, I've always felt like this since Porsche and Seabed, I guess that was a realization for me that like they're not on our side, you know. We need to like create cracks and force the light through. So I don't know, I guess that's why I come at it from a kind of ironically kind of optimistic perspective, because
that sounded glass half full to me.
I know, right? But it's because I worry that like the world is getting worse, right? But if you come from it with that as a baseline, then you know, all of these things are opportunities. Does that give us a segue to the global economy?
Does it? Does it? Is big economy after us?
Oh, big economy? Stop it.
If I knew more about Sex and the City, I could make like, you know, narrations, Mr. Big joke about this, but I don't.
You should do it.
I'm sorry.
Like nice. Narrations, but in Trump's voice. It's like last week on blah, you know, like that kind of thing.
Oh, that's good.
On the last Dragon Ball Z.
Fuck off.
Oh, back to the stuff.
Philip was wondering how we could segue. He said, we've got the worst segues. It's terrible what they're doing to our segues. Sure. Will that happen to our Warriors this week? We don't know. I'm going to say the Treaty Principles Bill. I'm going to say it. Do you want me to say it, folks? I think they want me to say it. I'm going to say it's 2 out of 7 Dragon Balls. I'm going to rate that segment 2 out of 7. I think we can do better. We can do much better.
Okay.
Great.
Meanwhile, in global economy,
yeah. Is the business. Meanwhile, in the rest of the world.
Meanwhile,
I have to be in total agreement, Mr. Trump, about that. In fact, I love your work.
Turning the newspaper page to the business section.
Quite literally. Yeah.
Quite literally. Look, tariffs. I assume if you're listening to this podcast, you probably haven't been living under a rock. You know, there's some stuff going on.
Nothing ever happens. Nothing ever happens, Philip.
Nothing ever happens. People left in absolute ruins. Yeah, good fun, basically. Trump announced like a categorical kind of sweep of tariffs. We're not going to go through them all today because, come on, read the news once a week at least.
No, I want to know the numbers for St. Kitts and Nevis.
Oh, so that was 71%. I'm making this up.
10% actually.
Well, now it's, yeah. Oh, do you have them in front of you, Jenny? You're scanning.
This is going to make you so much better at Tradle. You have no idea.
Imagine just like off the dome, my level of autism. Just like remembering the trade.
Not the trade autism, but the tariffs autism.
Yeah, that's exactly.
A mind palace with just percentages around each different location.
Doing the Sherlock, like Minority Report sort of thing with your hands.
Yeah, but specifically with tariffs.
Swiping aside Hound Dog to show like 25%.
100%. Well, yeah, you know, we're all 10 now, apart from China, which is great, I guess. It's fun, isn't it?
So yeah, good. Exactly. So the changes were after the initial kind of sweeping posterization of not in a good way, not posting in a good way to be clear, but like putting up a poster with numbers all over it, and then the bond market's freaking out. Basically, you know, 30-year yield bonds looked at risks, which I think probably was one of the catalysts, because that's mortgages in the US, and once you lose the mortgage belt, you're kind of screwed politically. Trump obviously caved to the bond markets, so he said a 90-day pause. He clears still a pause, right? Like, that's not really hitting many headlines at the moment. For 90 days. 90 days is not that long. That's really, you know, on the scale of geopolitics, that's no time at all. But paused everyone at 10%, which, you know, if he'd announced that every country in the world is getting an additional 10% tariffs from the US, that in itself is a shock to global markets, right? Like, that's a pretty fucking significant change to the flows of trade and logistics around the world. So look, there's lots of ways we could take this conversation, but like, I think a couple of interesting things that I just like to kind of inject as framing, and feel free to disagree if you disagree. I thought the kind of the silver lining initially for New Zealand's trade perspective was that our competitors were tariffed more highly than us. So if you were like a wine exporter, right, these tariffs were actually probably good, because if you're selling high-value wine to the US, which is what a lot of our wine export is, then your main competition is the EU, which had a higher tariff, and therefore like more people were going to buy New Zealand wine. So there were kind of silver linings. Those silver linings no longer exist, right? So from a New Zealand perspective, this is maybe worse than our initial kind of numbers were looking at. But the second, like more interesting, like geostrategic thing maybe, is that I think this really gives the lie to what was always clearly untrue about the like reindustrialization strategy from the like populist right, quote unquote populist right, you know, the idea that we being Trump was going to bring jobs home to the US. Because if that was your strategy, why would the bond markets freaking out be all that it took? Because like, isn't the plan to make it so expensive for countries to sell shit to you that those countries have to re-import their beautiful, wonderful, perfect, like manufacturing jobs back to your country? You need those countries, like those companies, to be hurting. And obviously the fact that he didn't have like a industrialization strategy or any kind of industrial strategy at all already showed that that was bullshit, right? But the fact that he caved so fast, I think really just like puts the nail in the coffin of anyone claiming that it's about jobs, or that it's about higher paying American jobs, let alone the fact that like the high-paying manufacturing jobs aren't because they were in manufacturing. They were because they were unionized and of like decades of struggle, blah, 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 blah.
Somehow this is also Dearborn, Michigan's fault.
Yes, right? Of course, which is the exact opposite of, anyway. And then the fact that he's been like musing about the US defaulting has just like continued to freak the markets out. So this even toned down move hasn't, like, it has staunched the bleeding, but it hasn't completely, like, it's not stopped, you know, that's still getting worse. Bonds markets are still going up. People are selling US dollars, which is insane. Like, I think this is such a bad sign. We're at the potentially like a tipping point. If he makes one wrong decision at this point, that could be like global recession easily, global depression possibly. It's brutal. Like, China's the second largest holder of US bonds, and they're allowing their currency to fall against the USD. So as long as China's careful about the kind of capital flows in and out of their country, which I think is like an interesting point, they're in such a prime place right now to just reshape the global order in a way that we haven't seen for a long time. Anyway, that's my kind of what I have been thinking about for the last couple of days. And
lying
then,
in bed at night, you're just like, oh man, like I wonder what the Chinese are going to do with all this American bond.
Yes, absolutely. And fewer, fewer tourists are going to the US. They don't trust the US anymore. They're not interested in going there. China's going to meet the EU officials soon. Mm-hmm. And like that possibly presages like a change in global order that we haven't seen probably, since the Berlin Wall stuff. And bond markets are still going up, which I can't get over. Like that is incredible. I really thought this 90-day pause would be it for because, traders love Trump, right? They're into it. So the big hedge funds I would have thought would have been quick to turn around. And they were. There was the highly publicized kind of, post backflip bump. But the fact that overall things are still going down, that is, I think, terrible news.
That was like insider trading on a whole economic, like national economy level, right?
Yeah.
But just like, and people inside the Trump administration, doing big trades and then immediately after announcing like, oh, no, we're going to pause the tariffs and then the markets shoot up again. Like, come on. He's just playing it like a casino.
Yeah. And it turns out the global economy is more than just a casino.
yeah. Well, I don't know. The LIBOR scandal might suggest otherwise, but.
It is partly a casino, but. When a lot of the investment players are like retirement funds or kind of long betting Warren Buffett style kind of operators, then it doesn't like it's not as sympathetic to those whims as I think the kind of day to day finance and establishment kind of headlines would have you believe. Because like just the bond markets are brutal, right? They will kill you. Like, there is nothing more. It was James Cagle, I think, who said, like, if I wanted to come back in my next life as, like, a powerful person, I'd come back as the bond markets. Like, that shit will fucking wreck you, But usually it's leftists who are concerned about changing something economically and the bond markets destroying them. So it's something I've spent some time, like, thinking about how you get around. And it is, like, it's a knotty problem if you want to be engaged with global trade and not wrecked by finance capital through the bond markets. But it's fascinating to watch it turn on one of their own.
It is. I mean, it's like what racists say about white people basketball teams. China focuses on the fundamentals. Not that flashy, showy LA Lakers stuff. Like there actually is some kind of grounding and foundational basis for the. I like how you all mute while you laugh. Just. Let it out. Let untuck now, Queen.
I don't want to over.
I'm so shocked the way you said, like all white basketball teams, and then that's the analogy that came out. Like I wasn't physically capable of.
No, this is what people said. They're like, oh, back in the 1970s, basketball wasn't all this like show off stuff. It was they focused on the fundamentals. It's like you're talking about how white people just dribbled. Like,
but never let it be said that 1 of 200 isn't au fait with sport metaphors.
That's right. That was a home run, actually. I think you'll find we professionally call it that.
And what a catch it was. One of those.
That's right.
Back to the basketball players. Continue. I'm listening.
Back to Jaina, which hasn't come up in a while. I do think there is a kind of foundation, there is a kind of grounding to China's economy. And so whereas I think the US has become entirely services and, increasingly abstracted financial instruments, which was true even pre-2008 global financial crisis. In fact, that's what precipitated it, right? The synthetic CDOs and other kinds of really arcane financial instruments based on something which was just arbitrary value going up, these kind of home loans and sales of real estate, that China actually has industry and it actually has these trading partnerships. It has the Belt and Road Initiative. It has, it's forging these relationships with the EU and with a lot of other kind of sub S tier power players in the world, these kind of collectives for trade. And it is, and it's also developing in the long term its partners. So, like developing Africa to then in the future have partners that aren't tied to the United States and will be kind of reliant on China as a sort of, like benefactor and then being vassals, this long game, the long game, if you will, being played. And
oof.
That one's for you, Jenny. And that is quite a distinction, because in the US, you know, you've got this, you know, people often say, you know, why does the stock market not reflect anything that's going on, all of that sort of thing. But the situation with China is that it actually does have, you know, to use pick a metonym, engineering marvels like the Three Gorges Dam, which is why you're seeing all of these crazy fascists on Twitter being like, we're gonna blow up the Three Gorges, because it's like, why? Because you're jealous that you can't actually build anything in America anymore. You know, there is some kind of like that the vector for their bloodthirstiness is reflective of the emasculation and the kind of small dicked feeling that a lot of these white American right wingers have. And I don't mean that in a sense that's like legitimately body shaming. I mean that they feel this. There is a kind of psychosexual angle to their insecurity as patriots. And it's bizarre that it's coming out like that. But China is in such a good position in comparison to it. People talk about it being in the ascendancy. But while it is in the ascendancy, and that is true, it's not only one where, you know, it's just some arbitrary thing like the renminbi is getting higher in value. In fact, quite the opposite, that China is playing with those levers in order to be able to strengthen its position as the global hegemon in however many years' time. It's pretty darn close to eclipsing the United States as a superpower. And there's almost nothing that could stop it now, I think, bar a kind of nuclear exchange, because it has those fundamentals. And it also has what's his name, Matt Iglesias, called, like, wanting 1 billion people in your country, you know? It has that. It already had that. And they've taken the brakes off. The one-child policy, not there anymore, baby.
Yeah, people in China be fucking now, guys, in case. Okay, we were already doing that, but now we're officially doing it.
One person lying flat, suicidal, like, tired worker. Two people lying flat, baby. There's a baby coming out of that.
What page of the Red Book is that on?
What do you think 996 stands for? What do you think?
Come on, it's right there.
Come on.
It's right in front of us the whole time.
It's in plain sight.
They've got the fundamentals.
Yeah.
If we just put a U between communist and manifesto, we get... Okay. I actually had a...
Communist.
One thing I was thinking about myself, not while I was lying down in bed, actually, overnight over the course of 2 days.
While you were lying flat?
Yeah, while I was lying flat, I was thinking about Christopher Luxon. Oh, God, no, fuck, that's such a bad implication. Shit, no, well, I was...
What I would say to you is, Jenny...
While I was seated upright in my chair at the office in an entirely non-sexual manner, I was thinking about Christopher Luxon. Mainly because I think he made some comments about working with the European Commission or the European Union in light of these tariffs. So I don't know, he hasn't really given... too much comment, I guess, on New Zealand's response necessarily here, but it looks like he was doing the whole like, great, heard about this, now I'm gonna like call everyone that I know in my like government phone book and see what I can make happen. And so I think what he's done is he mentioned that he was talking to people or world leaders that were part of the Comprehensive Progressive Trans Pacific Partnership,
CPTPA,
which is like
trans, but it is CPTPA, yeah.
That thing, yes, that thing.
The Cis-Pacific partnership.
Yeah, more like the Cis-Pacific partnership. Got him. Got him, Simone.
Got him.
Sorry.
But no, like he was talking about basically going to meet with delegates from the European Union, essentially, and talking to them about how they could contribute and coordinate with the CPTPP. And even though he doesn't think he could sign everyone up to the CPTPP, I fucking hate that abbreviation now. He is, I think, basically as a country, we are making these moves and having these conversations about essentially tying our own trade routes and trade programs more strongly to the EU. And so we think about who's in the CPTPP, that includes all the ASEAN countries, Singapore, Malaysia, Vietnam, I think as well. And we also have Japan in there, and we have the United Kingdom. So I think we almost see, in a way, a reformation of the old European Union bloc, plus the UK, and I guess our current Pan-Pacific trade partners. And I'm just wondering, essentially, if, for example, Donald Trump has a stroke and then the tariff situation is unresolved, we do almost see alternative trading blocs start popping up now. And the emphasis appears to be from comments made by EU leaders and also strangely by Luxon, which was like a really weirdly smart thing for him to say because I'm not used to him saying smart things. But they were really focusing essentially on rules-based trade. They were like, okay, we really have to do stuff by the book now. It's got to be, it can't be in some crazy guy after too many Big Macs, like gambling with the levers of the economy. It's got to be rules-based trade, collective action, collective commitments by, and I'm quoting directly from Luxon here, a large portion of the global economy, and that it's completely necessary to preserve free trade flows and protecting supply chains. So in my mind, okay, we're going right. We're going to meet up. We're going to bring Oceania together with the UK and the EU and our Pan-Pacific Asian trading partners. What's going to happen then, I suppose, to the US's current import-export schedule with a lot of these people? They're going to be given probably, I think the EU has the ability to give them potentially a better deal than what the US has been giving them. And opening up these smaller trading partners to bigger markets, like, and also opening up, I guess, Central European country markets to big players like Japan, for example, like Vietnam, Singapore, who makes nothing of its own and has to import everything. I think it's a really, really big step for some of these countries that might have been on the fence about whether or not they, I guess, go with American hegemony or like start to think a little bit freer in terms of trade. So I thought that was interesting in that even Luxon has had like a moment of sentience, you know, in the barren expanse of his brain and been like, oh, actually, you know what? We do love rules-based order. And obviously someone's fed him that line because that's not his usual, I guess, like tenor or tone. But the fact that it's reached us is really interesting. And that there is a larger body there, a larger trade body, probably the EU at this point, who is trying to move opposing levers to Donald Trump's drunken levers on the market right now.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it goes almost full circle to what we were talking about at the beginning of the episode about like neoliberalism versus like, just full, I don't know, robber baron fascism. Like, because that is the standard, right? Like that for most of our lifetimes, that's been what New Zealand is like a free trading neolib like cog in the fucking grinder of international trade, which like doesn't work for poor people, but like of course the people who succeeded through those mechanisms, like an airline CEO, that's how he'd think about the world, is that like free flowing capital and people makes money for logistics companies, and therefore like movement and transport and all these things continue to ascend, and people who didn't succeed through their own like brilliant merit at whatever like Christchurch Boys High school they went to, like unfortunately don't fall upwards up the pile. But the complaints about the TPPA, like it's interesting that you say like the CPTPP, because before it was the CPTPP, it was the TPPA, right?
That
And
was, we had so much opposition to that. Like, it was actually crazy.
yeah, I was part of that opposition. And when the CP w was added to it, not to start a whole new like spiral based conspiracy, like Jacinda very publicly was against it, and then when she became leader, she said, "Well, what if it was comprehensive and progressive, and
Yeah,
therefore,
that's right. P stands for progressive, so it's good.
yeah, what if we put some adjectives on there that were like peace and love agreement for trans-Pacific countries? And everyone was like, yay, we love that. That's so good.
painting a
Never believed
rainbow,
in magic till I saw my dog turn into a snake. Jacinda Ardern.
painting a rainbow on the side of a F-35." Of like New Zealand trade agreements, but
And then running into it, Wile E. Coyote style.
yeah, yeah. But we're obviously in like a fundamentally different geopolitical environment now from where we
Exactly.
were in the early 2010s, and like it is hilarious to watch the flips, right? Like the US was the big bad at that point in terms of the trading threat, and then Trump pulled out of it, so now it's no longer like these companies being dominated by the US, which doesn't mean the agreement is good for working people in those countries, but it does mean that like the geopolitical dynamic has fundamentally shifted. And the entire reason that shit was set up was by American operatives who wanted to exclude China from a Pacific arrangement, right? And it was the pivot to China, blah blah, all that like Obama era shift in geopolitics. But I think it's fascinating that now that Trump has kind of reignited the neoconservative isolationist instincts on the right in the US and unilaterally pulled out of it, that takes away that threat, but opens up new opportunities again, because it means like that organization can now pivot in a way that's not run in the same kind of way. And I don't think we're going to put the toothpaste back in the tube in the Republican Party in terms of free trade. Like, I think the next Donald Trump is also not going to be a free marketeer. I don't think Mitt Romney too is going to be the next
Oh,
leader of
God.
the Republican Party, you know? So who knows? Like, the EU, CPTPP, China bloc, that's the world, right? Like, at that point, we're isolating the US and not vice versa. And you're right, like, that's an exciting prospect for the rest of the world. I think the tipping point will come as the currency percentages change. Like, at the moment, I think in terms of dollar reserves, the US is still like 60 something percent. Euro is like 20 something percent, and Renminbi's like nothing, basically. That's the big barrier. But as those numbers change, which they're already starting to, it'll take a while, but you know, we've got the fundamentals.
You know what everything's going to be pegged to? The blockchain, Bitcoin.
Blockchain, fuck off.
Yeah, currency. I'm just imagining somebody from Christchurch being like, "And what school did you go to?" And you're like, "Shang, sure found that's it."
You're just
Yes.
yeah, like the Beijing Trade School for plumbing or something. Just
Yes.
like they have all these vocational schools, I think, in Asia and stuff that people are not ashamed of going to. So it's so bizarre when like people here are like, "Ooh, where did you go to school? Like Westmere or whatever the fuck?" And someone's like, "No, like school that taught me how to be a tradie. Like those are real schools. They're good."
It's fine because you know it's fancy because it's in Beijing, so you know it's got to be, surely, right? That's right. I think my dad taught at one of those schools.
Oh, Lord.
He got successively like pushed out of anywhere cool. So like he started off as a university teacher, and then like after a few years of being like white boy expat there, he eventually had to teach at like a high school, and then in Beijing, and then he had to start teaching at a high school in like Gansu province because you know it just had to get like worse and worse over time as he alienated everybody at his workplace. And that's how you know you're doing beautifully well as a quote unquote expat.
Did you see what Winston Peters was saying though, basically about Luxon reaching out to other people? He was like, "What the fuck are you doing?"
Yes,
He
he yanked Luxon's leash, and
was
not
like,
in a
"Sit
hot
down,
way. He was saying, you know,
bitch."
I who do you think is the prime minister here? It's me. You know, I've never seen this before. Somebody saying who was a, you know, the foreign minister from a different party, a party that got like 5% of the vote, something like that, saying to the prime minister, the first minister, the most important person in the country, saying, "Why didn't you consult with me? You know,
Did
I'm the
he
grand
actually
vizier.
correct?
I run the state." It was bizarre. I mean,
Feel like this is
Luxon's just so weak.
like there's a way like an abusive boyfriend tries to gaslight you. Like, why do you tell me you were gonna do this? Like, you're just so emotional. You're just completely overreacting. Like,
Winston Peters
what are
going through
you?
Luxon's contacts, being like, "Why are you friends with a boy on Instagram?"
Yeah,
Oh my
literally,
God.
like, why are you texting Keir Starmer at 11 p.m.? Like, you know, like that kind of shit. Like, it's exactly that kind of stuff, right? Like, it's just like,
Why are you liking photos of trade
I
deals
believe in a
without
sensible
money?
amount of cheating, actually. Perhaps a small liaison or tryst in the Hamptons.
Oh, God.
We can only dream,
Can
literally.
only dream. Was there anything else on the agenda?
No, but like,
No, nothing now. We're
I
just doing
think that.
bits for the next half an hour.
Yeah, that's right, everybody.
That I thought exchange probably betrays like two things, right? Like, one, obviously, Winston thinks that he can do that in a way that he couldn't with previous leaders, but also Luxon didn't tell him about those calls, which probably every other prime minister would have, you know. I saw Helen Clark say something on Twitter, the Some Things app, about to corner phrase again, about like, that is unheard of to not tell your foreign minister about the calls with foreign leaders that you're taking, like that, which he's just not good at this, right? He's bad at the job, he's not a good politician, and I think that's politics, that's not governing. Like,
He's a C-suite star. He's too showy. He's doing alley-oops. He needs to focus on the dribbling, on the fundamentals, okay?
build a bridge, Luxon, and then we'll respect you.
Build a Three Gorges in the South Island, and then we'll talk.
Now we're talking. Replace Three
That
Waters with Three
Muldoon,
Gorges.
think big.
That's right. Let's go back, baby.
With the new version of Think Big is going to be Think Chinese. I think that's where we're going with this.
Big Chinese.
Red
Think
Vern to
Chinese.
think Chinese. Yeah.
Red Fern, did you say?
I said Red Vern. I'm pronouncing the V in return.
Oh, Red Fern. No, I mean, but
Oh.
Red Fern works. It's like, you know, New
Yeah.
Zealand, but it's like the vassal state to China.
Ooh,
A
yeah.
vassal state for China.
Another accidental coinage.
Accidental. We're red ferners.
New Zealand, the 24th province of China.
Okay. Yeah. New campaign slogan just dropped.
It's like how we're just in the Australian Constitution. It's like, you know, just one of the states. We just don't like participate ever.
Yeah. I mean, that could work. Imagine the amount of infrastructure development we'd get.
We get maglev. I would love that, right? For us. We get maglev instantly like that.
New Zealand is actually New South East Wales.
Okay, that's pretty good. And on that bombshell, wrap. Thanks, team. Jenny, any final thoughts for the week?
I want maglev now, so we could become a battle state quicker. That would be really great. Like, let's just hurry that shit up. Do the red fern logos. If we have a flag referendum again, someone please submit. One of our listeners who can draw really well, please submit like the red fern idea. Like, I'm begging you to do it.
We've got some. Yeah. Let's go, listeners. Let's get artistic. Send us some shit.
Specifically your best ideas for flags that would indicate Aotearoa's new place in the world as China's vassal state.
Yeah. Look, we're all going vassal state. It's just, as usual, we're 20 years behind. But
I'm giving tribute to the Qin Emperor. I'm getting together my Tal coins. I'm offering up 100 eunuchs, which are just my friends in a Discord server.
Oof, brutal. Some of us are here, Simone, and it's a little to out us like this.
Sorry, just giving us back to the Empire like that. Yeah, like, yeah. I mean, I would go willingly, you know, I would accept a bribe for a position of privilege in the Empire, but still, like.
We're doing sortition for orchiectomies. We're just taking random members of the population.
Simone, any final thoughts for the week?
Yeah, so many. I'm always thinking big thoughts. I'm thinking big. I'm thinking Chinese. I'm Chinese Muldoon. That's a free display name for any of you out there. And I agree, Maglev. You know, I'm sick of getting, now that I'm in Tamaki, these notifications from AT saying the trains are up for one day this week. Sorry for the convenience. I'm sick of that. I'm sick of people pointing at like a 15-year long plan to, you know, do this a crazy, amazing rail expansion. And then I look at the map and it's a small, tiny circle in one part of the isthmus. What are you people talking about? You think so small. You have such like little Trump energy about this. How is the CRL or whatever it's called a major game changer? It's tiny.
I mean, we need to
be thinking big. We need to have maglev. We need to have, like, if you can have a slow train, have like an overnight, you know, like 200 to 300 kilometer an hour train. That's not that fast. You know, up and down the country several times. Get rid of, you know what, we should sell all of the airport shares and then like just destroy the airport with hammers after we've made money out of it, and then build rail. Okay, that's what we're doing next.
Amen.
Nice. I saw to go full circle and finish on an anecdote, as Simone started.
To connect up the CBD to Ponsonby, yeah, about this.
Doing the CRL of segues, right?
I was in Greylin last night, and I walked up a road, and there was a tiny sign. We're talking like...
More like Galen.
Oh, Simone, comes to our city. Yeah. Comes to our city and immediately starts deriding and making up new, entirely appropriate nicknames for suburbs. Devastating. There was like an A4 core flute sign stuck to a traffic sign, and it said construction is planned on this road, traffic will continue as normal. And I was like, thanks for the fucking notice.
That's literally the vine. Road works. I hope it does.
I'm on it. Like...
By the way, if you're a listener and you're uncomfortable and wondering if I have the pass, I live in Mount Albert, so like, you know, I know which of the Mount Albert noodle houses is the good one and which one is the bad one. I'm going and getting their bubble tea like at least 3 times a week. Okay.
Hey, nice.
I'm going to the laundromat instead of buying a washing machine. Okay.
Oh my god. Okay. Let's wrap. Thanks, team. That's been another episode of 1 of 200 After a Fashion. My name is Philip, and we've had Simone, and we've had Jenny. And we will catch you next week.
Bye.
If artifices are denied, live in a pointless life, but learn in all your lessons. Fucking politics, there's no distinction. The words of Parnell is paid with good intentions. And I'll admit that I'm at a loss for what to say when they quote this as a cost me or to stay. Cause I live amongst the people every day in this vindictive, forgetful fucking rain. It feels like we're on the road to hell.